there, everybody, and welcome to this game week edition of the NFL Roadshow. We made it through the offseason. Though, frankly, I kind of love the offseason. I've said that a million times, at least the early part through the draft. But obviously, games, this is what we're all here for. So excited to finally see what these teams look like, how the rookies fit in, what the free agency moves do to change the trajectory of a team's success. We've been really deep in the weeds this offseason with each other talking about these moves. Now we finally get a chance to see what it all means when it actually matters. Starting with Cowboys Bucks on Thursday, 9 early games on Sunday. We've got 4 in the late window, 1 in primetime, 1 on Monday night. Quick pitch for you, if you don't have DirecTV Sunday Ticket Max, but you do have DirecTV, there's a free preview this week, which means that you get Red Zone with Andrew Siciliano on Channel 703 and Fantasy Zone, which is the show that I do with Dan Helly and James Coe and John Hansen and the Dr. Mark Addicts. You'll also see every out-of-market game. We have a lot of fun on our show, so I urge you to give it a shot. Spend some time with us. Again, it's free this weekend, so what do you have to lose? In the meantime, really excited about this week's guest. He is an outstanding writer and podcast host for The Ringer and Spotify. You know him from The Ringer NFL Show and Slow News Day. He's Kevin Clark. Let's break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
2-1, 2-1, 2. Ready? Three.
Kevin, it's nice to meet you. this is a weird way to meet people. I feel like I've met so many people this way in the last year and a half.
I know it's the new normal now. Meeting a person for the first time, like in person, is now the crazy thing.
Super weird. I'm a huge fan of your work.
Thank you.
The entire scope of it is really blows me away. The fact that you cover so much ground. I mean, you're writing about like F1, golf, soccer, obviously the NFL. Mm-hmm. And every time you drop a new article, it makes me feel like a loser that my brain doesn't have expansive nature to like take all of that information in a way where I would feel confident reporting on it. But also, I'm just wondering like what your regular life is like. How do you find time to cover all of these things in a way that is competent?
I'm just faking it, Lindsay. I don't know any of these.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah. I've never seen an F1 race, never seen a football game. No, it's I would say that it's majors and minors, right? And so for football season, now that it's started, you know, there was an F1 race yesterday. In fact, it's a good example. There was a golf tournament that was important yesterday. I could kind of flip through the channels, but it wasn't the same as it normally is. But when it's May, June, July, I get my fix of those other sports. And then I just want to write about it. And the cool thing about The Ringer, Lindsay, is that we're able to sort of flex our muscles in that regard and just sort of, okay, hey, I'm really into this. Let's lean into that passion and let's do it. And so I think that I just love sports and have from an early age. And I also have kind of a short attention span. And that helps in this regard, because it's like, hey, right now I'm really into Brooks Koepka. Let's watch 20 Brooks Koepka YouTube videos and then write about him. You know, that could be right before the Masters, something like that. F1, golf, college football. You know, I'm a huge college football fan. I don't really have the time in NFL season to keep up with what's going on with UCLA and Chip Kelly. But on a week like last week, they have the entire sports landscape to themselves. I was able to watch every game. I was able to buy my Phil Steele guide and just go through the 2 deep and all that stuff. So it's more about when you have the opportunity, really dig in and understand what the stuff's all about.
Or you could just like go on a walk.
So there's a couple of ways. So first of all, I do a lot of listening on the radio with my wife. If I'm working out, it's a lot of podcasts, and I do listen to music and I do like music and all that stuff, but it's a lot of multitasking. I will go to Central Park with my wife and do the things, you know, we were just at the beach over the weekend, that sort of thing. But then it's like, hey, we'll just listen to 4 or 5 podcasts in a row on college football, whatever it is, F1, listen to, quite frankly, a lot of Sirius XM when it's a golf tournament, just keep abreast of that. And so I think that you can multitask. You don't have to. I mean, I have obviously some coworkers who are really into baseball, really into basketball. That to me is much harder to be into. Yeah. Because you're home every night. And, you know, I was joking, Ryan Russillo, my colleague, we did this thing a couple months ago. And he was like, I've never been to Montecito. And he always wanted to go to Montecito. I said, well, why couldn't you go to Montecito? And he was like, well, the Charlotte Hornets are on. Right. And like that, if you're into basketball, It's like, that's it. You're sitting there watching one of the Ball brothers every single night. And so with football, it's a little bit easier. It's sort of event-based. You know, I'm also a huge boxing fan. Well, there's what, 5 boxing fights a year that matter? So you really, it becomes events-based and you can do deep dives around that event. And so I pick my sports very, very carefully.
You mentioned the golf obsession this year. I know you've been tweeting about that a lot, and Brooks Koepka. So this golf reality show that they're working on for Netflix, are they going to be able to mirror this whole F1 thing? Or?
That's a great question. So the F1 thing, there's a couple of things that are really important. If you haven't watched the F1 thing, there's a couple of differences there. Number one is that you have a teammate, and the teammate has the exact same car as you. And so the analogy that I use is, imagine if Jimmy Garoppolo and Trey Lance were both able to run with the ones with the 49ers in different, you know, stadiums, and you got to see exactly which one was better, right? There'd be so much more animosity. The rival would be heightened. The press conferences would be different. Every step along the way would be slightly different because you get to test out your theories. No other sport is like this. No other sport has two people where your teammate is also your rival, because it's the only person where you have the same variables. So I think that golf actually has to lean into its humanity, I guess you could say. Guys who are trying to make the cut, guys who are trying to change their lives, guys who don't like each other. And I think that the key is going to be showing things that agents don't want people to see and that golfers don't want people to see. And that, to me, that's every league. That's every league. You know, if you try, one of the problems with Hard Knocks over the past couple of years is, okay, I understand it. If I was the GM of the Raiders, I would not want the Antonio Brown stuff shown. But if I'm the producer of Hard Knocks, I want an hour devoted to Antonio Brown. And because they don't have, I guess, unfettered access and don't have final approval, it's a different type of deal. Whereas F1 would absolutely have, you know, I would say this about F1, but they want to show the elephants in the room, and not every league wants to do that. Not every league wants to lean into those sort of uncomfortable truths about their sport. And my only advice to the folks who are making this show is just don't be afraid to show these guys as human. Because, by the way, as you know, a lot of these athletes do want to be shown as human. They do. Well, like, they want to talk about this stuff. Just find those guys and tell their story.
Well, a few of them have been talking about it.
Yeah.
They can't help themselves, right? The ones that don't like each other.
Right.
Like, that's
Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau. Yeah. And the guys, even further down the line, you know, I mean, Patrick Reed, obviously, there's a lot of animosity towards him. Like, you have to show that stuff.
So one of the articles that you wrote most recently was about Dan Campbell. I thought that this was very interesting on a number of different levels. I'm wondering if you had an idea of what you were in for. Did you have a picture of Dan Campbell in your mind that you felt actually was kind of like you were on the right track, or were you surprised in any way when you went there and spent some time with him?
I was surprised at how much he'd thought about the way he comes across in public, because I knew that
he doesn't seem like someone who thinks
I think that he's thought about it. I think that he's thought about his public persona, looked at it and said, I could change, but I don't want to. And that, to me, is admirable, because when I saw the kneecap stuff, or he's wearing racing helmet during one of the minicamp press conferences, I was thinking, like, this is a guy who loves football and can't help himself. And what I was curious about is, when I sat down with him, was he going to say, I can't help myself, I don't know what to tell you? Or was there a longer thought process behind it? And the answer was, he can't not be himself. And he knows that. And he does not want, this is something, the first thing he said to me was, he doesn't want to sit down and write a speech. He doesn't want to do it. And he wants to say, if the kneecap phrase called to him, which is what he said, he wants to be able to say it. And I think he's almost like a politician, in the sense that he knows who he's talking to. And he's talking to his constituents. And in this scenario, his constituents are not you or me. It's the players and the fans. That's all he cares about. He does not care about the national media, doesn't care about NFL Live, doesn't care about Bill Simmons podcast, whatever it is. He just cares about Taylor Decker and Jared Goff and those guys. And that, to me, is admirable. And I don't think that, for me, I think that a lot of times these guys, and you've met these first-time head coaches, and so much of their shtick is just stealing the from the last guy they worked for, or they worked for, I mean, Dan Campbell worked for Bill Parcells and Sean Payton. It would be so easy for him to be Parcells or Payton and be grouchy and do the anti-media thing that both of them have done at times, even though they've both been very good at times with media. But he's just going to be Dan Campbell. And I think there's a confidence level that you need to have that foundation and say, I'm just going to be myself. Because, I mean, I remember Eric Mangini talking about this, where he said that when he thought about whether or not to be like Belichick in the media when he got the Jets job, his thought process was, well, who am I to say I know better than Bill Parcells? Who am I to act differently than Bill Parcells? Bill Belichick. Who am I to act differently than Bill Belichick? Because Bill Belichick's figured it all out.
Yeah.
And I understand that thought process, but I also understand that you got to this level, this head coaching level, because you've been yourself and because there's a certain quality that people gravitate towards. And I think that you have to keep that or else once you lose it, you may never get it back.
How smart do you think you have to be a head coach?
So
I think there's an authenticity that you want, you know, you want the guys to like you, you want that to be able to be relatable. But I feel like maybe the trade-off, and maybe this isn't fair, but some of the stuff about biting kneecaps and whatever doesn't feel very like weedy or particularly like someone who is a smart person approaching football. So you kind of get like a little bit of a meathead reputation, right? Like, which I think was his reputation even when he was down right. in Miami to a degree. And one has nothing to do with the other. And he's just a brilliant football mind, but it doesn't feel like those are the types of things that are coming up, but maybe that can work. I don't know what the right combination is.
I think you can have two things can be true at once. You can have the tough mentality or be funny in the national media as Campbell has been and still be a brilliant football mind. I mean, I think that one person who was, quite frankly, if you polled the other 31 coaches, would have been laughed out of the room at the time he was hired, is somebody like Doug Peterson. And Peterson showed that he was able, I mean, remember Mike Lombardi, who was my colleague at the time, called him the worst hire, the least qualified person to ever, whatever. And I like Mike, whatever Jason Kelsey said at the parade, when making fun of that comment. But I think that a lot of times how a coach is presented at press conferences and with the national media, with the local media, on television, I don't necessarily think that has anything to do with how good of a coach they are. I mean, I think that people have been, I think people have been underrating Matt LaFleur for over 2 years now, because we haven't understood that he has a real presence. And that when I'm with Matt LaFleur in Green Bay, I talk to him and he's a different guy than he looks at press conferences, and he's a lot more forceful and he's got a real grasp of that team. And so there's a disconnect, I think, a lot of times in what a coach is perceived as and what he is in the locker room. And I think that's really important. I mean, you think about somebody like Andy Reid. Has Andy Reid ever given a good press conference? Ever? I don't think so. Not that I remember. I mean, I've probably been to 25 of them over the years, and I've never been like, oh man, Andy's lighting it up today. Yet, everybody who knows him says he's hilarious. Everybody who knows him says he'll send you funny text messages, or he'll give motivational speeches, or he'll tap Eric. You know, I think it's a chance for him 2 years ago. He tapped Eric Bieniemy to give a motivational speech. He understands what needs to be done as a football coach. And he's smart as hell, but I don't think that he is going to use his brain power in giving you or I good quotes. So I think reputation in the media and coaching acumen can be two different things.
Do you, traveling around, meeting all these different coaches, players, things like that to profile them, do you find yourself rooting for the people that you end up liking? Like, how do you approach that as somebody that then is charged with talking about their ability to do their job well or not?
I don't root for those things, because I consider, if I profiled someone, I consider it kind of done. I don't think that if I, and you don't stake your claim to it. If I had said, Dan Campbell is going to win Coach of the Year, and within 5 years is going to win a Super Bowl, then yeah, I'm way more invested. But I didn't say that. In fact, I went out of my way to say, listen, I got no idea if this is going to work. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can tell you is that being yourself helps as a coach, and Dan Campbell is himself. That was the only claim I was willing to make, because who knows, that roster lacks talent and all that stuff. So if I staked my claim a little more, I'd probably secretly root for those things. I would say that if I'm rooting for anything, it's a story idea I have. I mean, I'll tell you a story. Probably the only time I've ever rooted for anything, like actually truly rooted for anything since I became an NFL journalist at the NFL level, was I had a pretty good Tom Brady feature ready to go. And we had saved it for the championship game week in 2015. And it was about how when he plays catch with guys, whether that's in June or July or closer or in the season, he's like obsessed with it. And he makes his receivers look into the sun before a game in Miami just to play catch with them, all this stuff, all these little details. So we had held it, and they were playing the Ravens that weekend, and they fell behind a lot. And I was talking to my editor, and I was like, oh my God, I spent 4 months on this piece and it's not going to run. I don't know what to do. Like, I was crestfallen. I was in a hotel room, and it was the game where Julian Edelman had that long touchdown pass, if you remember, and yeah. they won. And I remember being in my hotel, and I was just like fist pumping, and I was just so excited. And I don't care. The Patriots yep. are not, they don't help me. As you know, I've asked one question to Belichick in my life. They are not an access team. The only thing I cared about was my story running. Yes. And so that months didn't go down the drain. But that was it. I don't have any, if I say a team is going to win and they lose, I don't care. As long as my story can run and it can be done, that's all I care about. But I've always felt like that you just kind of see the ball, hit the ball. And so I think the best example of this is after a Super Bowl, when you're talking to these guys. I mean, maybe you see a guy where it's like, okay, this guy grinded on 7 different teams. He was an undrafted free agent. You're like, oh, I'm happy for this guy. But that's mm-hmm. about it. I mean, you're actually, I know this is a weird thing to say, but you're a little too busy to root for anything or to be like, oh, this is great, or I want this to happen. Like, you're kind of just processing it and just hoping you can get something out of it and get a good anecdote when you're at the Super Bowl level or the AFC title game level or whatever. I mean, you know that just as well as I do, that you're just trying to do your job, you know?
Yeah. It does get a little bit weird though, if you do have a relationship with anybody or like they've been kind to you or something.
Yeah.
I've run into this. So personally, my example, I guess, is Jason Garrett has been so kind in my interactions with him. And in these last few years, I'm kind of like biting my tongue a little bit, you know, sometimes with the Giants offense, and like, feel like you want to give a little bit of benefit of the doubt or not pile on or not be the joke, you know, on Twitter or something like that. Although that hasn't been my MO anyway, just because I've interacted with so many of the people that like poking fun at them has never felt right. Maybe that wouldn't have felt right if I hadn't interacted with them either, but.
I think the best policy for me as someone who's an analyst and has to say, mean is the wrong word, but I've got to rip people if they stink at their jobs. And what I've tended to do is if I have a good relationship with somebody, I'm going to say like, hey man, like I really, here's what I'm going to write and here's what I think, and just be honest with them. I mean, when I sit down with a profile subject and I know it might not be, you know, I think the Dan Campbell one was pretty, I mean, I told him kind of where I was coming from when we were talking, but I would say that there are some profiles where, I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was in Tennessee and Mike Mularkey was the head coach, and we talked about the spread offense and Marcus Mariota and sort of how he could do this. And he basically ripped the spread and was like, no one who once thinks the spread can work at the NFL level knows what they're talking about. I'm not going to run with Marcus. I've been doing this for 20 years, et cetera, et cetera. And I knew that my column coming out of this was going to be negative. Like in real time, I'm just like, Mike, I'm sorry, buddy, but like, this is what I'm going to say to you. And then you end up getting more of a give and take, and you end up getting to say, hey, here's what I think about this. And then he gets to say that back to me. I think that's productive.
Totally.
You know, I worked at the Wall Street Journal for 5 or 6 years, and our big thing was no surprises. and we were not allowed. I would get in huge trouble, not fired, but somewhat short of it. If I wrote a column saying, you know, the Dolphins are the worst team in the NFL and so-and-so should be fired and Steve Ross should have to sell the team. I wouldn't write that, obviously, but I'm just giving you an example. If I didn't call the Dolphins and say, here's what I'm saying, the editors of the paper would get very upset. And that's just an old school journalism
thing.
Wow. And so I have in my sort of journalism bones, the need to give everybody kind of a fair runway and just say, hey, listen, if tomorrow I was going to write about, I don't really know Jason Garrett all that well. Dallas is kind of off of my radar the last couple of years. And as you know,
you're the only one in America, but
well, no, there's so many media members there.
Uh-huh.
And also the access is so good. You end up, last time I was at training camp, or I've been to a bunch of training camps, but it's like, you can grab the coordinators, you can grab the players. It's like Jason Garrett almost becomes, he's also not a great quote, he almost becomes an afterthought. So I actually don't know Jason Garrett that well. But if I was going to write this huge column saying Jason Garrett is the worst coordinator in the world and needs to be fired, my guess is I would at least reach out to the Giants and give them the opportunity for him to talk. And that to me, it doesn't absolve me. And I there's certainly been times where I've had really good conversation about a story before or after it was published about somebody I ripped. But I think that that's the best way to do it rather than just sort of dunk on someone on Twitter who you have a relationship with. Just give them the opportunity.
And the truth is so it's never this or that. It's never black and white. It just isn't. Like, it isn't Jason Garrett is, you know what I mean? Like, the story, you could say that. You could say like, oh, he's just blowing it and he's the worst, most uncreative, whatever. But then if you go to him, I guarantee you that there are some reasons. I guarantee you that there's more to it than actually that. Now, he might not publicly say point finger, whatever. Hey, I can't do anything with this guy or whatever, but there are usually things there. So I think that having a dialogue about it where you actually push back a little bit, and it doesn't have to be even necessarily when you're sitting with Dan Campbell, hey, here's the negative thing I'm going to say. It could just be literally having a conversation saying the negative thing, or like pushing back with like, well, why this, or what about that, you know, and giving them a chance to respond to that. I think it paints a fuller picture of the whole situation.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of times at this level, I would say 90% of the time, especially with a GM, I would say coaches are less so, but I would say most GMs at this point are pretty aware if I've said positive or negative things about them. And so you're not going to be able to hide from that. You're not you can't be passive aggressive about it. If I say to someone, if I say someone should be fired, then the GM is most likely, maybe not on the podcast, but I mean, I remember getting a call. I'll give you a great example. I remember 2017, on a podcast, a guy I have a relationship with, I said, his defense is terrible. It was a GM. His defense is terrible. They can't win anything. And that day the podcast went up, I got a call from him and I was like, this can't be good. And he was like, I just want to have this conversation. Okay. So it's September. And he said, I believe that post CBA 2011, that defenses only get better as long as they stay healthy, because with training camps shortened, no two-a-days, all this stuff, the fact that the players are younger and they're going to take longer to understand these offenses and all that stuff, that a bad defense September doesn't matter. And first of all, he was right. The team ended up being quite good. But second of all, like, those are the conversations you get if you want to have open and honest dialogue with someone and being okay. Like, I have to be honest with you. Like, I think there are probably reporters who wouldn't even answer the call in that situation, and certainly wouldn't just say like, or maybe try to weasel their way out of, hey, you know, I wasn't really, and I was just like, no, this is how I feel. And he said how he felt, and it was awesome. And like, if you can have those kind of relationships with sources or with people in the league, use it and just have like open, in the same way Dan Campbell said this, I'll say this too. Bluntness and honesty are a very good thing in football.
So it's week one. I've spent 24 minutes with you prior to even getting to a game, which I love. But there are so many great games and so many things that, so I am the kind of person that, like, week one, I'm less excited about watching the Chiefs and the Bucks and some of the teams mm-hmm. that I kind of know. Like, I am somebody who loves all of the weeds of the off season and the draft and the free agency moves and all of that stuff. And then also fantasy and trying to figure out what it all means yeah. for the season. So my games that I'm the most interested to see are the ones where there are big question marks, right? Like which direction is this team going to go in? How are these moves going to actually affect their ability to be successful or not successful? What does it all look like? Who are you most excited to see?
Great question. So I think that I'm with you. There are some fringe teams. And what's funny to me is the fringe teams were playing each other. Mm-hmm. And so one of them gets to be overrated. So, like, a great example,
because we won't overreact, but
yeah. I think both of these teams are maybe wildcard teams or in Washington's case, division winner, but like the Chargers yes. versus Washington. Mm-hmm. That's a game where I'm like, man, one of these teams is going to win. And God forbid, if one of them blows out the other, we are going to say, oh, here comes the Washington defense, or here comes Justin Herbert, whatever it might be. I think that's the funny thing about week one. You have the Eagles and the Falcons are on the same boat where one of these teams is going to win and they're going to say, hey, all the haters who said we were terrible, you know, screw you. It's like, okay, well, you beat another team that wasn't all that good, even though actually the Falcons have a chance this year. So I'm with you. The Browns and the Chiefs, like, I'm really excited to see it. I have a Browns story running tomorrow, but
yeah,
both of those teams are going to be there in January. I'm good on that. Like, I don't need to, I want to see how the Browns secondary holds up against Mahomes, but I'm not freaking out either way. I think that it's more interesting to see, I'd say, Dolphins versus Patriots, two teams that might have answers or quarterback, might not. Two really good coaching staffs, two really good front offices. I'm excited to see that stuff. Cardinals, Titans, Vikings, Bengals. I mean, there's just a plurality of teams that I have question marks about that are playing each other
yeah.
to where you not only get the, okay, maybe this question is going to be answered, or maybe the team they're playing is just awful. And you see, you get a second level. It's almost like a great teaser for week two to find out which teams we thought might be real in week one are actually real in week two.
A team that I'm positive is going to be awful. Well, it's one we've talked about quite a bit so far is the Lions, yeah. but I am interested in watching their game against the Niners for obvious reasons with regard to the Niners. We got to see what Jimmy looks like and how long yeah. he's going to be able to hold on to that job. But then also the Lions, and this is the fantasy football person in me, I have no idea where the ball's going. Right. Like, I don't know what the running back rotation looks like because they're so weird calling Williams their A back and all that kind of stuff. And then, like, I don't know. Is Tyrell Williams their one? Is Amon-Ra St. Brown any good? Like, having nothing to do with competitive football, I'm curious to see, like, what it will actually look like because I have absolutely no clue.
So you made a couple points that I think are really important. And I think that, obviously, the Garoppolo question is huge. And by the way, is there going to be a Trey Lance package? And how much is there in the splint on the finger? How much did that matter? I think with the Lions, I think they're going to be really bad this year. And I think that they're, you know, it's funny because I remember being in Miami in 2019. And that was the year they were embarrassed, as you remember, by Baltimore really early in the year. They were losing games by 50 points. Everyone was saying this team should be relegated, all this stuff. And then by December, they're beating the Eagles. They're beating the Bengals. They're hanging with teams they shouldn't be hanging with. And they're building a culture, hanging with the Pats. And they're building a culture. And so I think you can be bad and build a culture at the same time. I'd say that the Jets are in that boat as well, mm-hmm. Where you can win four games and still be showing that you're rowing in the right direction. And I think that's the benchmark. That's what the Lions should be judged on. I agree with you. I'm pretty sure they're going to be bad. I have no, this is not an answering questions weekend for them. I think we've answered the question, right. But I think as the season goes along, they can show us stuff where we go, oh, okay, this tracks.
Who do you think is tracking in the wrong direction? That's in that like middle of the pack. Who do you think is not building?
I'm getting a little concerned about the Bengals because I love Joe Burrow. Burrow is one of these guys who I spent some time with on a training camp tour. And I just really, I really like them. And I'm worried. I think the offensive line has improved, but I don't know how good it's going to be. The Jamar Chase pick, the jury's still out. I'd say I'm still a little bit, you're talking about middle of the pack. I'm still a little bit concerned about the Raiders here. I don't see much hope for them. I'll also say, you know, I know this team's been buzzed about because they might solve the quarterback problem maybe after this year, but I just don't see much from the Broncos. You know, Bradley Chubb appeared to have an off-field incident today on Tuesday. I don't know. I mean, I think that I'm just transcribing an interview with the GM, and he was saying that, you know, the number one thing you have to concern yourself with is the quarterback position settled? And then once that happens, you can go from there. Well, Denver, it's not settled, and it won't be all year. And so I can't in good conscience pick the Broncos to do anything because I have no idea what the hell is going on there. So
can you wrap your brain around why they passed on Justin Fields? Does that make any sense to you?
So the GM, George Patton, said, and I actually don't think this is a crazy, I don't think this is an uncommon idea in front offices. He said that he thinks it's easy to get a premium quarterback, easier than, in the sense that somebody made this, I called around on that after you told Peter King that. And I called around on that. And okay, it's not just Aaron Rodgers. Maybe Russell Wilson's available after this year. Maybe a couple other guys are available after this year, whatever. That put that separate. But like, I think that I think when GMs say that, and I have heard others say that, I don't think it necessarily means guys like those two. I think that they mean like, okay, Carson Wentz is a viable NFL starter and he was available for a package of picks, that kind of thing.
But he was the worst quarterback in the league last year.
I'm completely in agreement with you. I would have taken a quarterback if I was the Broncos. I would have taken a quarterback. I'm just saying that that to me sometimes is a front office's thought process. I think, and I'm sure you've been around GMs like this too, and there's a lot of overthinking in front offices. And I think that that's something that is pretty important to remember, that sometimes GMs just have a little too much time on their hands. And all of a sudden they're saying, hey, I've got this crazy theory. And then they build a team around it.
Well, I mean, maybe I will be proven incorrect, but just having this conversation and knowing that that's the frame of mind, that actually makes me more concerned about the Broncos. I don't know if I feel like I can get behind the whole, and actually I'm a proponent of waiting on a quarterback if you're not ready to be competitive. You know, I actually do think that a team like the Lions had no business drafting a quarterback this year in the draft. And I know that some people disagree because they think if you have a chance to get a franchise quarterback, you got to swing on that. They're going to have a chance to get a franchise quarterback next year too, because they're going to be so bad that they're going to be drafting really high up. Also, I'm a proponent of build your entire roster and then plug your quarterback in when you're in a position to be successful or at least competitive so that you can maximize that 5-year contract on the rookie deal before you have to pay him the entire salary cap.
it's weird. The timeline on it is weird. I was in Buffalo a couple of weeks ago and some of those guys there were saying, we're so happy that Josh survived 2018 when he's playing behind a makeshift line. He's playing with almost no weapons. Yeah. Nobody around him can play. And they're like, God, he took so many hits. We're just thankful he survived. And I think if they had to do it over again, obviously everything worked out and it's fine. But I think probably in the back of their minds, they're saying, "Ooh, boy, maybe we should have not even played him that year because it was such a, they were spending $60 million in dead cap money that year. So they had almost no roster talent because they're trying to clear the salary cap and Josh Allen took the brunt of it. And I think that if you are the Lions right now, and listen, they have talent across the front, but still it's not, if you dropped any rookie quarterback into Detroit right now, he wouldn't look that good.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see if the same can be true for the Bears, because that O-line looked like a disaster in the preseason. And that's obviously a big problem there. Are there any individual players that you're eager to see, like that you have question marks about?
I mean, Burrow's high on my list because I still think Burrow can be on the superstar track. And I think that there's a possibility that we think that Burrow is an absolute superstar. And we end up saying, okay, maybe they need a change in personnel or coach or whatever. Or, I mean, if he's bad this year, I don't know what you do because we've seen how good he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be going into his third year.
And you gave him weapons.
You gave him weapons, but also the knee injury was bad. The knee injury was bad. And so how much of a mulligan would you give him? You know, when I talked to him, he had just started feeling like himself, but he said that when he looked at a play early on in training camp, his vision has always been his superpower. But when he looked at a play early on, he would just see a wall of people, probably like what you or I would see if we took a snap. I mean, I'm sure sometimes you look at practice from a weird angle. I do too. And I'm always just like, how does anyone ever see anything out there? You know, I think athletes a lot of times have like everything just appears slow to them. And I think that for you or I, everything looks extremely fast. And I think Burrow's vision, he admitted this early on, was much more like my vision than his normal vision. And so I think that that's the mental part for him. And how long does that take him? And how do you evaluate when they need to figure out what they need from a personnel standpoint? They need to figure out what they have in a coaching standpoint. I think that to me might be the hardest situation to parse going forward, unless everything is good this year.
How much do you make of what you heard in the preseason and training camp coming out of Cincinnati or anywhere, I guess, as a generality, in Cincinnati, it was so bad in the beginning.
Yeah. I liked the honesty there. When I talked about the honesty thing, Bill Parcells just say this all the time. The only way to get better is brutal honesty and saying, here's exactly what I need from you. And I said that to Dan Campbell, and he said, you know, there were times, this is in the story, there were times where he'd say, hey man, if you don't get better at this extremely specific thing, I'm going to cut you. And then he would see other players get cut after that conversation. So it definitely wasn't an empty threat. And because of that, because of kind of those people who talk, who say things like that, I actually am appreciative of honesty and actually think that getting it out in the open is an important thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that I put a lot of stock into it, but I also think that the fact that they were also open and honest is the only way to solve it, if that makes sense. And they were talking about it because I think it was obvious to every reporter, every defensive back, every photographer, anybody who had seen the Bengals offense run, I think that they saw not a good offense in the first couple of weeks. And so I think it's gotten better since then. That's certainly why they talked about it a little bit more. The play calling will be a little bit different, but I just think that it's hard to parse any preseason thought. You know, I mean, I had a conversation with Patrick Mahomes a couple of weeks ago where he was talking about rewatching the Super Bowl. And he said, you know, I looked at it and I was bailing early from empty pockets or clean pockets and all this stuff. And I think that Mahomes probably in his heart of hearts knows that he had no chance to win that game when he was getting hit that often. But he went out and found some of his flaws, I think, in a way to be a stand-up guy. And I think he wanted to set the preseason narrative a little bit and just say, hey, I'm taking responsibility for this. Let's move on. We've solved it. So I don't think that Patrick Mahomes is sitting there rewatching the Super Bowl and trying to figure out how to beat the Browns because of it, because it's a totally different line, totally different game plan, all that stuff. I think that it's a mixture of, hey, it's August. I have a new mentality. I'm going to talk about it. And once you go from August to September, those mentalities change very quickly.
We were talking about Joe Burrow and his ability to take the next step this year. I got to tell you, I'm now emotionally invested in that happening because one of my many fantasy
teams, we go.
Well, it's not my doing. So I got the time wrong on the draft.
Oh, no.
And I tuned in to the draft 2 minutes early in my mind and was actually 58 minutes late. And so it was round 13 and I was on the clock picking a kicker. And it was the last round of the draft and Joe Burrow is now my quarterback. So my own fantasy nightmare is what I lived through yesterday. Do you play fantasy at all, Kevin, or is that a separate world?
I don't. It's a separate world. And my go-to line on this, and this is the same thing with gambling on football as well. So I gamble on golf, not necessarily an F1 because it's weird odds. Boxing, combat sports, those sort of sports that are kind of my minors, I like to gamble on just because A, I understand it, but B, it's just fun to put, you know, $20 on some long shot. But for football, if I'm watching the Masters and I've got $50 on Xander Schauffele at 20 to 1, and he misses a 3-foot putt that would put him in the lead or whatever. I'm so mad at Xander Schauffele for like 3 hours. And my process is, I know myself well enough.
Okay.
That the guys I interact with, if I bet $100 in Seahawks to win and Bobby Wagner drops in a pick six, and I see Bobby Wagner like a week later, I'm going to be like,
you hate him. You hate him.
I'm
now.
Just going to be like, really, dude, really? You know what I'm saying? Just like, and so I need for my own separation, separation of church and state. I just can't have that extra layer of emotion. As we talked about earlier in this podcast, I want to be seeing the ball, hitting the ball at all times, and no emotion about anything. I mean, like the Patriots are a good example. I keep coming back to this, but like, I have no relationship with anybody at the Patriots, not one person. Mm-hmm. And yet, I will write the same story I would as if they were a team that I know 1 through 53 on the roster. And there are those teams where I can talk to five. There are organizations right now where I could get, you know, the top four people in the organization on a group chat, and we'll just BS for 5 minutes. Well, if that team plays the Patriots or some other team I don't have a relationship with, I have to feel the same way every single time. And so for me, betting is an extra layer of emotion that I just don't want. And fantasy is the same way.
Yeah. So fantasy for me was a way, when I first got into it, it was just an entry point for me to get like really deep in the weeds on about right. the lower people on the roster. You know, it was just to stay fresh about like who the number three wide receiver is. Cause especially when I was working at NFL Network, you tended to talk about the same people all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was like, whoever the best wide receiver is, and maybe if they have a good tight end and the quarterback, certainly, obviously always. And then maybe the number one running back, maybe the number two, if they catch a lot of passes or something like that. So for me, it was just like, I just need to be in conversations, or I need yes. my headspace to be in a place where it's taking in a little bit more detailed information and a fuller picture of what's actually happening. So, and then in the process of doing that, I kind of fell in love with it, but I usually don't have a lot of money on the line. And right. like this year I have 9 fantasy teams. So I don't think I'll be that invested with any one particular person yeah. failing me at the last minute. It will just be what it is.
I played a couple of years ago. My company had a TV show that was connected to it in 2016, and their TV writers were just like, hey, we were doing a fantasy league. Like, we saved a spot for you. And I didn't want to be that guy where I'm like, yes. all right, I don't want to give the same speech to them that I just gave to you, because they literally just put me in a league. And I was like, all right, you know what, guys, like, I'll play it. But I just put almost no effort into it. Like, I just did like the bare minimum because I didn't want to be a jerk. But if I got invested in it, that's when we get into the problem. So I'm with you on, I can play and not be invested. And it sounds like with 9 teams, it's hard for you to be invested. I would either, that actually might be the way to go for me. Instead of playing none, because I don't want to get invested, just play in every single league. And so I can't care about any of them.
Although the problem for me ends up being that I'm not strategic enough about the right. way I approach it. I'm like, no, this is the guy I actually like the most in this group. So I just keep drafting the same person over and over right. again. I'm like, I'm going to get Antonio Gibson if I can get him, because I'm all in. I think he's going to be great. I think, you know, he's going to outplay his value. And so then I end up with all of these teams with Antonio Gibson on them, unless I'm unable to get it. Okay, I've got a few rapid fire questions for you.
It's great.
All right. Favorite story you've ever written?
Okay. So I have an easy answer for this, because I was not on the national kind of radar when I was at the Wall Street Journal until I wrote a story in December of 2014 about how Andrew Luck compliments the players that sack him. And that to me, that changed my life a little bit, because I started to get interest from other outlets, and eventually it got in touch with Bill and all that stuff. But it was also that just separating the professional part of it. It was so funny to report that story. So yes. the way I got it was, a guy named Pernell McPhee, who was in Baltimore, had told me that the two funniest players to sack were Andrew Luck and Philip Rivers. And it was because Rivers would just talk trash to you the whole time. Even he would be stuffed with a ball 10 yards behind the line, shoulders hanging out, and he's still talking trash. And they told me the compliment thing. And so I looked at the Colts schedule that year. And I think the Colts had played every NFC East team that year. So I was like, I was in Baltimore. So I was like, amazing. What I'll do is I'll just spend the next 3 days going Washington, Philly, Giants, and just getting these guys and Patriots as well. And so I went into the locker room and just had a list of guys who had sacked Andrew Luck. And I just said, what happened? And their faces all lit up. And, you know, it was just so funny to hear Nolan Carroll, I think, had sacked him like the year before. And they all, it was just one of these stories that not only was hysterical and funny, Andrew did not want to talk about it because he just thought it was part of the game. But he didn't want to talk about it. He talked about it after the story ran. He would not, when I reached out to those guys, he did not want to speak about it.
But what do you mean he just thought it was part of the game?
He just like that was he has respect for the players. His thought process is I have respect for the players I go against. And this is just part of that. Nothing special. And so he did not want to draw attention to it. So but it was just I'm sure that you've had this before where you've hit on a storyline that everybody just wants to talk about. And that to me made it so much fun. And from there, got a little bit of momentum, a little bit of a hot streak, definitely changed my career and my life from there. Just a couple of different events that happened after that. And so that to me is kind of, there's kind of a BC and an AD of my career. And I would say that that month, a couple other things happened that month off of that are probably it.
Person who has changed your opinion of them most dramatically in the course of researching a story?
Jeez, that's a great question. It's not Dan Campbell. I'll say that. Blake Bortles, I would say. I did a story a couple of years ago about Blake Bortles, and I came away. I think a lot about these types of guys. I would put Nathan Peterman in this too, where it's actually incredible. Nathan Peterman torched Clemson when he was in college. He put up insane numbers. I was looking at the, I'm a huge college football fan, and I was looking at the recruiting rankings from a decade ago or whatever. Nathan Peterman was like a top 50 player in all of Florida, which is, you know, one of the best places to play high school football in the country. And to get to the NFL level and stay there, but be so bad, you're also a joke. Like, it is such a fine line. I mean, these guys, Blake Bortles is the best player from his town. He's the best player in one of the best players in UCF history, which is a huge school, 50,000 students. My dad's a professor there, right? Like in a huge city. And to be that good, but then be bad enough to throw four interceptions in a game, be a joke, be kicked off a team, basically, be someone who's criticized by an entire fan base. The level of emotional toughness he had to have to get through that, to me is really interesting. And I would say that's unique to the quarterback position, that there's so much, I think that there's some probably terrible right tackles, but they either get replaced quickly because there's not a financial investment in them, or they just don't get that famous. And I think at the quarterback position, you get a lot of the glory, but if you go down that Peterman Bortles road, you're in, I think it's Chris Long who's talked about this. Once you kind of get into the meme zone, you never really get out. And the only way to get out is to win big. And that's really hard. There's only four or five guys who can do that. I mean, for God's sakes, Blake Bortles got to the AFC Championship game and nobody cares. He's still a meme. And so that to sort of get to know people around him and to realize that there's sort of a human toll to all of this, you know, I mean, imagine, you know, once every couple of weeks, I'll get some guy on Twitter who's like, you should be fired. And I'm like, oh, man, I wish that I hadn't seen that. And there are guys in the NFL who see that stuff every single day.
Right. Yeah, it's incredible. It's one of the things that drives me crazy about like just having conversations with fans who are outside of our space, because the way that they talk about people, you know, it is that guy's a bum or whatever. And it drives me crazy. I'm always like, do you have any idea how good he had to be for you to think that he was a bum? Like if he really was a bum, you wouldn't know who he was. he wouldn't even exist on your radar because he wouldn't have made it through all of these different hurdles to get to the point where you're watching him play poorly or well. Okay, next thing. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I would say the same thing about the coaches getting fired, where it's like,
100%,
I'm only going to call for a coach to be fired if it's a, if it's obvious and clear, and that somebody, I mean, at some point, my line is to cross is someone is either not taking it seriously or they're putting a franchise in danger, or they're making reckless decisions or whatever, because it's not just the head coach who's getting fired. It's dozens of people, people you're not even thinking about. I'm the people on the damn PR staff, not let alone the quarterback's coach, right? So that's a big, and I think a lot of times we just say, ah, time for this guy to go. I mean, it's happening at the University of Miami right now, where I went to school. If people are up, time for Manny to go. And it's like, when an AD is looking at that, first of all, the AD himself might get fired, you know, if that happens. But like, you're talking about dozens of people, some of whom are just administrators who are working, making $60,000 a year. And I know it's a tough business, but I just wish there was a little more concern for that kind of stuff before humanity. You just recklessly say, you have a little more humanity. I'm as up for making fun of anybody as anybody, as we already discussed. But that kind of thing, I need to be shown a lot to clear his day, say this guy's got to go.
Person you've been most starstruck to meet or interview?
You know, it's funny because it's not really anybody in the NFL. You probably have this too, where if I'm in job mode, it's really hard for me to be starstruck. So like my favorite player growing up, I was just in that generation with Brett Favre. Well, I've probably seen Brett Favre 10 times and I probably don't even notice anymore. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You're just kind of doing 50 things at once, and it's not being jaded. It's just you know, if you're an airline pilot and you're flying a plane through through turbulence and your childhood hero walks in the cockpit, you're going to say, "Hey man, I'm busy now," you know? And that's just sort of, how I feel with that stuff.
So
when I'm not in that mode, when I'm at a boxing match and I see, I'll give you an example. So I was at the Wilder Fury fight. I was at both of them, but I was at the second one. And I saw Frank Thomas at the beer line and I'm just like, man, The Big Hurt. That's amazing. Like that's when I'm starstruck, when I'm not in I'm doing 20 things at once mode. Trying to think who I saw the Formula One guys came to LA, 2 years in the fall of 2019, did an exhibition and drove around Hollywood Boulevard. And I loved seeing those guys, Daniel Ricciardo, Max Verstappen, that whole crew, that to me, but Valtteri Bottas, Toto Wolff, all those guys were there. That to me was really cool. I enjoyed seeing that. Trying to think who else I've been starstruck by.
You know, it's funny. You said something that I totally relate to. Like I have this thing where there are people just working in this industry for so long. I've met so many people who are famous. And then I've also talked about so many people that I'm kind of at a point where I'm like, have I met them or have I just talked about them so much? Or have I done like, was it a talk back where I didn't actually meet them? There are people like Tom Brady. I have definitely interviewed him at least once that I can remember, but I don't know if I've interviewed him more than that. And I don't know if I've met him in person. And that feels to me like something I should remember, but I legitimately do not know the answer to that question.
I actually talked about this with someone last week. It's not starstruck because I didn't meet them, but a few years ago I did a phoner with John Madden. Mm-hmm. And it was in LA and I was sitting in my house. And that to me was like a, oh my God moment, because you've got your phone that I call my wife on, call my parents on. And like, it's on speakerphone and John Madden's voice, that iconic voice that's coming through my phone. That to me was more of a starstruck thing. I mean, like I actually, my favorite thing, and this is going to sound so self-aggrandizing, but my dad gets really excited about this stuff. And the funniest thing to me with the starstruck thing is that after that aforementioned catch feature ran, someone said my name at a press conference, like started it off. They're like, Kevin Clark had this, and Brady kind of did like a nod, like he knew who I was. And my dad like clipped it, sent it to like 100 people. It could have just been a natural reaction. I have no idea if Tom Brady knows who I am. But my dad was like, oh my God, Tom Brady We've nodded at my son's name. Yeah, he like gave a flicker of recognition when someone said my son's name. That to me was the funniest thing. He was so excited about that. So that is funnier than sort of if I sit down with Mahomes or Aaron Rodgers or anything like that.
Is there an interview or a story or an interaction that you've had that you would like a total do-over on that you regret?
Yeah. So my first meeting with Bill Belichick, I've been in press conferences with him and all that stuff, but at the owners' meetings, I tried to introduce myself. I came in hot with a question about scoring boom. This was March 2012, and they just had that big scoring boom the year before. He had no idea what I was saying, and I probably didn't make it clear what I was talking about. It's probably a terrible question. I was talking about Paul Brown or something. And he didn't know what I was talking about. He kind of correctly branded me as someone who had no idea what he was doing. And then afterwards, I tried to introduce myself, and he just kept moving forward. And I was walking with him for maybe 15 seconds, and he just had no interest in it. And like, I don't think there was anything I could have done. Like, obviously Belichick's not going to sit there. And I've seen interactions with Belichick since then that have shown me that I was not alone in that regard. I thought that maybe he was going to be a little different in those scenarios than maybe at the podium, because a lot of guys are. I mean, like,
yeah,
Bill Parcells is a great example of a guy who will be grouchy at the podium, and then if you get him alone, he's the nicest guy, and he's asking where you went to high school. I mean, a lot of times, you know, almost every GM interaction is the same, which is they ask you where you're from, they ask you where they went to high school and where you went to college, because they've all got some frame of reference from their scouting days, or, hey, oh, you're from Orlando, I used to scout UCF, I love this restaurant down on the Poplar Island Road, whatever it is. They've got some interaction. So I've always had the two people that just gave me nothing. One was Bill Belichick, and the other, I loved him, was Ted Thompson. Because I had spent all weekend, my first weekend, that weekend, March 2012, introduced myself to everybody. And I got the same kind of minute and a half long conversation with everybody. And I just remember introducing myself to Ted Thompson. He wanted no information on me, and he just goes, "Good luck to you," and walked away. And I was like, perfect. And so it was like those guys established very early on that they're just, you know, they were not going to be media friendly. And I am totally fine with that. There's a whole league full of media friendly people. Not everybody had to be that. Totally, so,
yeah. Gotta try. What if they were?
Never met with Ted after that. As I said, I've been in a bunch of Belichick press conferences, tried to talk to him in the past. Doesn't really, you know, I think that you had to get in. I've talked to this before. I think you probably had to get in pretty early for Bill, or have some connection, whether that's lacrosse or Maryland or New England or something like that. I mean, I did all I could. I read his father's scouting book. I knew a lot of the people around him. I had a couple of connections within the NFL to him. And I felt like, hey, if I just introduce myself and tell him what I'm all about, that could work. But, you know, it's hard to get in with Bill Belichick.
Hi, I'm Kevin, and I know Willie McGinnis, and I like lacrosse. Exactly. And would you like to talk to me a little bit?
I played a couple of weeks of lacrosse at Boone High School in Orlando. Please talk to me. Please answer my 10 questions.
Last question. Team you would consider adopting should Miami continue to break your heart?
I think UCF would be number one. I mean, yeah. Like, I so if the Hurricanes, I mean, God, Lord, they are going to continue to break my heart. Okay, let's get that out of the way. I'm never going to get rid of them. But if Miami like stopped playing Division I football, which, you know, they're only playing like that, they're actually going to do it. It would be UCF. They're from my hometown of Orlando. My dad's a professor there. I've been to a bunch of their games. Some of their big games, I was at the first game they played in their stadium against Texas, all that stuff. So that would be the natural thing. I just can't do it. I'm going to be a Hurricane until I die. And it's unfortunate.
Just a glutton for punishment until you're not, until they turned it around and then they're back on top.
That's right. One day that will never happen. College football has changed too much, unfortunately.
I know, I'm a Trojan fan. So,
yeah, well, I mean, it's a little bit different, but at least it's the same thing in the sense that recruiting became so national that it became really hard. There was a story over the weekend by Pete Thamel about how all the the Southern California quarterbacks leaving the state now. And it would have just been unconscionable a decade ago that some of these guys would go to Ohio State or Oklahoma or Florida or whatever. Like that same thing in Miami, where it's like some kid who went to Miami Northwestern or Miami Central or St. Thomas Aquinas, like those kids stayed in state and went to Florida State or Miami until about 10 years ago. And now it's anybody's game. So it's changed everything.
Yeah. Right. Like for people who have schools that have had some degree of success and have experienced that, but it also kind of ruins it because now the only thing that is acceptable in terms of enjoyment level for the team or the sport is like complete domination. So I'm in a position as a USC fan where I'm like, oh, we won that game, but it was close. And like, it just shouldn't be close, Kevin. Okay. Like we're not going to win the championship with close games against okay teams. And so it just ruins everything.
I've recalibrated to the point that I just want to beat our rivals and just playing a good bowl.
You're in a dark place.
I want to beat Florida State every year. I want to beat Florida when we play them, which is not every year. I want to beat Notre Dame when they're on the schedule, which isn't all the time. Like I went from when I was in school in 2009, we were like number 9 in the country and lost to Virginia Tech in the third game of the season. And then we started 3-1. I was like, we're going to win the national championship. And like, that was the last time I've had that thought. I may never have that thought ever again. Like even the year we made the Orange Bowl, I was like, this is a fake team. This is smoke and mirrors. I literally think I would never think that again.
Kevin, this has been fun for me. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
All right, that's Kevin Clark. You can find his work on The Ringer, The Ringer NFL Show, Slow News Day. Links to all of that on his Twitter and Instagram handles for both are by Kevin Clark. And that'll do it for this week's show. Back next week with a Monday episode. We're back to having multiple episodes per week because we're in season now and there's going to be so much to talk about. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. It helps people find the podcast. Very helpful. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app, which is free for most subscribers. Just download it today and tap podcasts. You'll find us there. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter at Lindsay_Rhodes. On Instagram, I'm Lindsay Rhodes NFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM podcast network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. Thanks to Chris Tyler for his help with this episode. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. And a special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen.
SiriusXM Podcasts.